First Samuel. We got into chapter 22 last time. First Samuel 22. Now we covered the first couple of verses, but starting there, David therefore departed thence and from the Philistines, where he had to feign that he was a madman before the king. But David therefore departed thence, verse 1, 22:1, escaped to the cave Adullam. We talked about that last time. The cross-reference to Micah says that Adullam was the glory of Israel. And so we spent some time with that last time. It's just nice to think about that once in a while, that, you know, sometimes maybe within the most barren times of what you think is the most barren times of your life, if you establish contact with the Lord, then that can be the most glorious time too. Verse 1, and when his brethren and all his father's house heard it, they went down thither to him, and everyone that was in distress and everyone that was in debt, everyone that was discontented, three classes of people that often are reachable. And so in America, we've had a tough time here because while folks are technically in debt, they don't realize it. And, you know, they're troubled about things, but there are so many answers and pills that the world just throws at them that they don't take what the Lord has for them. Everyone that was in distress, everyone that was in debt, and everyone that was discontented gathered themselves unto him, and he became a captain over them. And there were with him about 400 men. And so it's quite a band of folks. And David went thence to Mizpah of Moab. Now there's a Mizpah up not far from Jerusalem, and that was the part of the circuit around which Samuel rode and stuff. But there's apparently another Mizpah down in Moab further south, outside of the land of Israel. And David went thence to a Mizpah of Moab, and he said unto the king of Moab, "Let my father and my mother, I pray thee, come forth and be with you till I know what God will do for me." And I don't know exactly, but I guess the best guess is why David turned to the Moabites is probably the link where his, you know, David's great-grandmother was Ruth, who was a Moabitess. And so there may have been some contact still because of that, where, you know, David's great-grandmother was a Moabitess, but I can't say for sure. And David went thence to Mizpah of Moab, said unto the king of Moab, "Let my father and my mother, I pray thee, come forth and be with you till I know what God will do for me." It didn't look good for David at the time. He had said, there's but a step between me and death and all those things. And yet, you know, that from that really, what must have been a pretty dark time, and David not knowing what's even going to happen, that, you know, David winds up king. David winds up, with very prolific and the man after God's own heart, and had a grand life, except for his mistakes, of course. But God did a lot with him. And so just because it's a dark time for you, maybe spiritually, an unfruitful time spiritually, and maybe you feel like you're on the run from some things, the devil, the Antichrist, or the world, doesn't mean the Lord's done with you. Verse 4, and he brought them before the king of Moab, and they dwelt with him all the while that David was in the hold. And that hold is going to be in Adullam. It's a hold is a militarily fortified position, so good ground to avoid being attacked and that sort of stuff. Verse 5, and the prophet Gad and said unto David, "Abide not in the hold, depart, get thee into the land of Judah." So once again, that kind of brings up that whole thing from chapter 21 where David makes this plan and goes to the Philistines and had to, wrangle his way out of that by being creatively insane and all kinds of things. Just things went really bad. And the indication maybe is the Lord never wanted him to leave Judah. So he goes to Adullam, And the prophet Gad, who was one of the more influential prophets in David's life, Nathan prophesied to David a lot. Gad also prophesied to David quite a bit. In fact, they're together quite a bit if you look up the names a little bit. But the prophet Gad said unto David, "Abide not in the hold, depart, get thee into the land of Judah." So apparently God's will, if the Gad's to be believed, is that David's supposed to abide in pretty close proximity to where Saul is, and therefore making it easier for Saul to chase him. And the answer to that is, once again, I think I discussed this last time, but look, if you will, in Psalm 23. This is also worthwhile to contemplate in our lives as well, because Psalm 23 says, down in verse 5, among other things, "Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil, my cup runneth over." Now, we want a table prepared for us in safety so we can sit down and enjoy the food and not have to worry about anything. And apparently, in David's life here specifically, Lord didn't want David yet sitting down to a table where there was no danger. He wanted to feed him at his table that he had set in the presence of his enemies. Now, we'd just not soon not be in the presence of our enemies, but the fact is we always are. I mean, in this world, you're surrounded all the time by enemies. You know, you go to the Lord in prayer at, you know, your meal table, and the devil's there too. The world, the flesh, and the devil, your enemies are always here. And so just for now, until this is all over, till the marriage supper of the Lamb, the Lord intends for you to sit down at a table he prepares in the presence of his enemies. Back to verse 5. "And the prophet Gad said unto David, Abide not in the hold, depart, get thee into the land of Judah." So here is the Lord sending David back into closer proximity with his enemy, with Saul. And so sometimes you just have to acknowledge that, you know, again, one of those deals that doesn't make sense to us. You know, we want to be delivered safe. We want security and all those things. And just sometimes the Lord just wants you in the, you know, in the proximity of trouble. He just wants you to go through it. Verse 6. "When Saul heard that David was discovered, and the men that were with him." Now Saul abode in Gibeah under a tree in Ramah. Ramah was, once again, was where Samuel lived, having a spear in his hand. And so I picture this and try to put it in modern thought. You know, here's a guy sitting with a 45 pistol, cocking and uncocking it, just kind of fondling it all the time. He's cocking it and uncocking it and cocking it and uncocking it, you know. It makes you a little bit nervous. I mean, these servants know that Saul has thrown javelins at both his son and David. And so here he is fingering his javelin, you know, kind of caressing it, you know. And this guy's got to be thinking, I just hope that I serve his wine right, because this guy's nuts. He's going to pin me to the wall. Anyway, but he's sitting there, you know, playing with his spear, having his spear in his hand, verse 6, and all his servants were standing about him. "Then Saul said unto his servants that stood about him, Hear now, ye Benjamites, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards and make you all captains of thousands and captains of hundreds?" That's how a politician thinks. He's going to buy you off by giving you something, right? And so you'll be loyal to him. Now, the truth of the matter is that he's offering to give them that, but just recall what the Bible said earlier. Look in 1 Samuel 8. 1 Samuel 8. Saul's saying, you guys have got it good, and I'm going to give you all stuff, vineyards and acreage and all kinds of stuff, but just remember that what was prophesied about Saul, chapter 8, verse 14, "He will take your fields and your vineyards and your oliveyards, even the best of them, and give them to his servants." Well, he did. He's taken stuff away from somebody else to give to these to his sycophants that are sitting around him. And that's an awful lot like what goes on in politics, right? I mean, that's in the end, I mean, we talked about it some this weekend because he's in such proximity there. When the Bible says the love of money is the root of all evil, when you start thinking politics, then boy, is it ever. Because, you know, it just, I don't know if I want to go there, but there's just so much. And here's Saul offering these guys all this, all these dividends that essentially he's taking from somebody else to give them. So, you know, he's feeling sorry for himself. And so it goes on in verse 8, and all of you have conspired against me. We'll leave conspiracy for just a minute and talk about that in a minute. All of you have conspired against me. Now notice how many times me shows up here. And there is none that showeth me that my son hath made a league with the son of Jesse. There is none of you that is sorry for me or showeth unto me that my son hath stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as it this day. Now this guy is a, he's practically got his thumb in his mouth, you know. And, you know, it's a complete, you know, self, egocentric thing going on here. He's a conspiracy theorist that everything, everybody's against him. He's paranoid. Verse 8, that all of you have conspired against me. And this reminds us that in the latter days, men shall be lovers of their own selves, unless I'm mistaken, right? Look in Proverbs 14. this virtually screams to be put into the context of our day, because if there's something that men are, it's self-obsessed is what I'm trying to say. Self-oriented. Look down in what the Bible says about this and just read it. And next time you're just thinking about you, the backslider in heart shall be filled with his own ways. A guy that can't think of anybody but himself is a backslider in heart. Now, some would argue, well, you have to be a Christian to be a backslider, and maybe that's true. But I know an awful lot of Christians that can't do anything but think of themselves. But it says, a backslider in heart shall be filled with his own ways. All they can think about is what they do and what they have and what they want and how they feel and who's against them. And, you know, it's just, it's them. A backslider in heart. And a good man shall be satisfied from himself. Let me just chase down a few other verses here, if you wouldn't mind. Now, keep your finger in Proverbs, but go to Acts chapter 14 real quick, because it mentions this phrase again, Acts chapter 14. It's certainly individualistic. That's very true, but it's also across mankind. Look in Acts 14 and verse 16. Where in this passage, talking, of course, about the heathen's relationship with the living God. Notice verse 15, we also are men of like passions with you. We preach unto you that ye should turn from these vanities unto the living God, which made heaven and earth and the sea and all things that are therein, who in times past suffered all nations to walk in their own ways. There's that own ways thing. Lord, just let the nations run. And apparently he's letting this nation run pretty much that way too. But judgment always comes. It's the backslider in heart that is always filled with his own ways. If somebody can't talk about anybody but himself, that guy's a backslider. Now, he may not be a Christian, but if he is, he's a backslider. So sometimes you have to wrench your mind off yourself. Best thing to have is something higher to do. You need a high calling so that when you would normally in your old life have just been dragged down, entangled, and swamped by your own sorrows and your own problems and your feelings and all the things, all the wrongs that have been done you through life and how nobody likes you anymore and all that stuff, you still have to get up, and there's still a noble and high calling that you have to perform today. You have a Bible to read, and you have a God to reach out to and pray to, And by the grace of God, a family to support that you manage to be responsible for, in spite of the fact that you feel so sorry for yourself for it. And eventually those dark times pass, and you're kind of back normal. But you have to have somebody, something to come bring you through those dark hours. Let me just keep running here on this, somebody being self-obsessed a little bit. Again, back to Proverbs 21, just a few verses in pretty close proximity. And just to remind you how this goes, and you know, you can wind up, and here is Saul who's wrestling with an evil spirit from the Lord. That's what the Bible keeps terming it. And that's true. But somewhere there's got to be some sort of, you know, when the Bible talks about a corrupt mind and folks not thinking right anymore, there has to be some sort of cooperative effect of being deceived, not wanting the truth, being deluded, not thinking right because you just dwell in darkness, and then spiritual interaction with all that. And by the time this is over, as you well know, Saul is as crazy as a March hare. And March hares are really crazy. But he's nuts. And so you look around, and sometimes these days people are nuts. And a lot of it is not just spiritual, and a lot of it's not just the world. It's a cooperative thing between the two. Okay, Proverbs chapter 21, if you wouldn't mind, 21, and notice verse 2. This is just a commentary on how men are. It says there, the backslider is filled with his own ways, but in 21:2, every way of man is right in his own eyes. Now, you know this verse, but the fact is that without outside light, you'll just have a tendency to think that you're right. You're that cocky, you're that proud, and you're that haughty. You think that you're right. And the chances are you're not. Look down in verse 8 of the same chapter, 21:8. The way of man is froward and strange. That's a commentary on what a man is like. The way of man is froward. The word froward means willfully contrary. It means that if you knew what was right, you'd probably rebel against it. And there's an awful lot of that that goes on every day. The way of man is froward and strange, but as for the pure, his work is right. Let me just chase a couple other verses down here. Back to chapter 18, Proverbs 18:2. Here's another commentary on that self-obsession thing. A fool hath no delight in understanding, but that his heart may discover itself. That guy's locked in with thinking about himself. He's trying to discover his own heart. He's apparently one of those kook brain artists, or else a college student who is out trying to discover himself. Amen. His heart wants to discover itself. All he's interested in is self-discovery. That must mean he's lost to start with. But a fool, who is that guy? He is a fool. He has no delight in understanding, but that his heart may discover itself. It's all self-consumption. Look, if you could, to Jeremiah chapter 10. Just a little bit more back and forth here about this. Jeremiah 10, some verses came to mind. Jeremiah chapter 10 and verse 23. O Lord, I know that the way of man is not in himself. It is not in man that walketh to direct his steps. That ought to be a verse that you pin on the front of your Bible somewhere. Because without that book, you ain't got any sense at all. I mean, in the end, you chasing through life, you're groping in darkness. You're stumbling against everything possible. And you don't know what you're doing. I mean that for me, too. I mean, I was a college student once, led down that road. I was saved, but backslidden. And I mean, they messed my head up for a while. And they will, because they're wrong. You are by nature a spiritual creature. You were intended to seek unto the light and the truth. Your mind was designed to work a certain way. If you put the wrong garbage in it, then you don't think right. I think about that virus that apparently Cassie, Stacy Quigley's sister-in-law, swallowed or breathed in during yard work or something. There's something you take in, and before long you have an infection and you're septic and ready to die. I wonder if that works spiritually at all with thoughts, you know, with what you pour into your mind. Anyway, there's all those things. Let's go back to verse 8. Here's pitiful Saul sitting under a tree caressing his javelin as he's waiting to pin somebody else to the wall, apparently, and all he can think about is himself. All of you have conspired against me, he says in verse 8. There is none that showeth me that my son hath made a league with the son of Jesse, and there is none of you that is sorry for me. Well, yeah, sorry, big boy. But none of you sorry for me, or showeth unto me that my son hath stirred up my servant. He's now blaming Jonathan for stirring up David against Saul, which is stupid. To lie in wait as at this day. He's saying David is lying in wait for me. David's a lion. He's, oh yeah, I want to show you this. Look over in 23:22. He's saying David's lying in wait against me. He's trying to ambush me. In verse 22, go, I pray you, prepare yet and know and see his place. Talking about David, where his haunt is. Oh, David is haunting me. He's haunting places. He's lurking. That's the other word I wanted you to see. Verse 23, see therefore, take knowledge that all of all the lurking places where he hideth himself. David is now a lurking haunt. He's a lurker. It's a weird word. He's lurking. You know, the lurker is the guy hiding around the corner with a trench coat on, you know, and all that stuff. But he's lurking. It's complete delusion. Back to verse 9. 1 Samuel 22:9. I didn't have throat problems that I caught here. Then answered Doeg the Edomite, which was set over the servants of Saul. This is the guy that the Lord had detained, and he's the one that saw all, you know, David coming in. And said, I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, the priest. And he inquired of the Lord for him. He, Ahimelech, inquired of the Lord for David. Now that was not something that he did. It never says that Ahimelech inquired of the Lord for David. Now, the rest of it's true. He gave him victuals. That much is true. He gave him the showbread, right? And gave him the sword of Goliath, the Philistine. But you see how that's phrased? Where when he tells it, you know, he inquired of the Lord for him. He gave him victuals. He gave him the sword of Goliath, the Philistine. That all sounds like Ahimelech is conspiring to help David. And that was not true. In the first place, the first thing he said was wrong. He did not inquire of the Lord for him. He gave him food, reluctantly, right? He gave him Goliath's sword, reluctantly. And so, two-thirds of what he said is true, but it still misrepresents what David did. There's just a way of telling what's mostly truth, and damning the person you're talking about. It's a tonal thing. I've often learned that, you know, it's one thing to have, you know, to find out that your kid did something wrong and you have to go deal with it. It's another thing to have somebody else have to come tell you the tattletale that has to come tell. It just seems so much more scandalous. It's hard to explain, but you see if it's not that way. Okay, you hear something about somebody, and it may be partially true, but there's a way of telling it where it's almost like they're just vile and guilty, and that's not quite the case. You know what I'm saying? Got to be careful how you tell stories. That's why gossip and slander is so bad. All right, verse 11. Then the king sent to call Ahimelech, the priest, and the son of Ahitub, and all his father's house, the priests that were in Nob, and they came, all of them, to the king. And Saul said, "Hear now, thou son of Ahitub." And he answered, "Here I am, my lord." I mean, he's not scared. He, you know, "I got called. What does the king want?" And Saul said unto him, "Why have you conspired against me?" Now, there's that word again, used back in verse 8. Second time, "You've conspired against me." Okay, kind of interesting, the word conspiracy. First time the word conspiracy is used, it's used regarding Joseph being conspired against by his 12 brethren. Now, Joseph's a type of Christ, right? And the 12 brethren are a type of Israel. And so here's Christ being conspired against in type by his brethren. Now, the next time that the word conspire is used, it's here in this passage where here's Saul, a type of the Antichrist, crying and whining as if he's been conspired against, and he hasn't. So you have a whole bunch of people in this world right now that feel like they've been conspired against by all the powers that be and everybody else. And the truth is, it's not true. They made their own bed, and the bed they're sleeping in is the bed that they made. It's ridiculous. But just keep in mind, the first time it shows up, it's somebody in type, at least, conspiring against Christ. The next time it shows up, it's a type of the Antichrist who feels conspired against, though it's not true. By the way, the next time it happens, Absalom, who is also a type of the Antichrist, conspires against David. And furthermore, one of David's good friends, Ahithophel, joins in the conspiracy. So again, the type of Christ is the one being conspired against. It's just kind of interesting, those the way those things work out and kind of the context of stuff, because you hear a lot about conspiracy theory these days, right? A lot of it is just a bunch of hooey, okay? And the grand conspiracy is the devil being against God. And so you can make it the Bilderbergers and, you know, all this racial stuff and everything in the world that everybody dreams up and all that stuff. In the end, the world, the flesh, and the devil are against God. And because you still dwell in the flesh, if you're not careful, you're involved in the conspiracy. So just kind of keep that in mind. That's why a lot of us are not interested in being dragged off into the deep, dark details of conspiracy theory. Because it's kind of hard with conspiracy theories to know where facts stop and where nonsense starts. Yes, it is. It really is hard. And conspiracy theory is always kind of trying to shove you towards doing something stupid. The Lord doesn't need more of his people doing something stupid. I mean, really, he doesn't. He needs you to be level-headed, prudent, and wise in your dealings. He doesn't need a bunch of people running around like a bunch of chickens with their heads cut off, you know, with guns and knives and stuff, hoping to, you know, figure out who's conspiring against who so they can kill them. It's crazy. I mean, you just be level-headed. Be a normal dude, okay? You say, well, there has to be conspiracy, and there is, but you ain't going to do nothing about it. I mean, how many people have you known that have gotten caught up in the whole political struggle, and it all amounted to what? No red wave. Right? I mean, new guy, and he took off a year from his pulpit to go try to get the church constitution or the state constitution changed so that we could stop homosexual marriage in our state. And it didn't succeed. And he almost destroyed his church along the way. you ain't going to change nothing. You're one person, you're one vote, and if you got out and went on the road today, are you going to be more popular than Trump or DeSantis? Or, for that matter, any of those other guys? You don't have the money to spend. You ain't going to change nothing. You're wiser to stay with the high calling of God God gave you, and you're not going to make a whole huge amount of difference in this world. You're not going to make all the lives of all the poor in the world better. You're just not. You're not going to take care of all the orphans, because there are more orphans born every day than you can possibly ever deal with. So you might as well take care of the little pea patch God gave you. Take care of it carefully. Do it earnestly unto Him. And quit thinking. Quit allowing yourself to be dragged into a bunch of stuff that's going to waste your time, your youth, and all your energy. Not to mention your money. Just my little, soapbox. Verse 13. And Saul said unto him, why have you, this is Ahimelech the priest, conspired against me, thou and the son of Jesse, in that thou hast given him bread and a sword, that much is true, and hast inquired of God for him, that he should rise against me to lie in wait. You helped him to rise up against me. Verse 14. Then Ahimelech answered the king, and said, and who is so faithful among all thy servants as David, which is the king's son-in-law, and goeth at thy bidding, and is honorable in thine house? He said, man, it was David that came to me. He said, I would have been more afraid of turning David down, thinking that if he's on your business, you might come kill me for not helping him. And now you're going to kill me because I gave him some bread and Goliath's sword. So Ahimelech is in that position where he can't win, right? Because Saul is unreasonable. Verse 15, and did I then begin to inquire of God for him? Be it far from me. Did I inquire of God for him? No, I didn't. Be it far from me. He didn't do that. That was a false accusation by that jerk, Doeg, right? Verse 15, did I then begin to inquire of God for him? Be it far from me, let not the king impute anything unto his servant, nor to all the house of my father. For thy servant knew nothing of all this, less or more. He said, I have no clue, had no clue any of this was going on. David came and said this and that, and I thought it was weird at first, but I gave him bread and I gave him a sword. I did not inquire of him. Who was I to turn him down? He's your son-in-law. He's your right-hand man. He's the head of your mighty men. Who am I to turn him down? Verse 16. And the king said, thou shalt surely die, Ahimelech, thou and all thy father's house. And the king said unto the footmen that stood about him, turn and slay the priests of the Lord, because their hand also is with David, because they knew when he fled and did not show it to me. Completely unreasonable. Can't get my throat cleared. But the servants of the king would not put forth their hand to fall upon the priests of the Lord. And the king said to Doeg, turn thou and fall upon the priests. And Doeg the Edomite turned and he fell upon the priests and slew on that day 85 persons that did wear a linen ephod. And so here's how crazy Saul is. He commands his footmen to kill the priests. And they say, we ain't killing them. And he didn't kill them for insubordination. But he'll kill the priests. See what I'm saying? How crazy is that? It never says that he kills the footmen for being insubordinate to him. But he went ahead and had Doeg kill the priests. He's crazy. He's nuts. Verse 19, and Nob, the city of the priests, smote he with the edge of the sword, both men and women, children and sucklings, and oxen and asses and sheep with the edge of the sword. So he killed everything. Just one last little bit here. And one of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David. And Abiathar showed David that Saul had slain the Lord's priests. And David said unto Abiathar, I knew it that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul, I have occasioned the death of all the persons of thy father's house. So at this juncture, Abiathar is, remember that you have, I didn't get the board out, but we went through this in 1 Samuel that through Ithamar, one of Aaron's sons, through Nadab and Abihu got killed, right? The Lord killed them. Ithamar was one of the other sons. Through him came Eli's line. The Lord pronounced judgment on Eli's line that Eli's line would not continue. So at this juncture, after the killing of these priests, Abiathar is the only one left of Eli's line. And the other line was through Eleazar, from which came Zadok the priest. Now, as time develops here, as we'll see it a little bit later in Samuel, both Zadok, son of Eleazar, on that branch, and also Abiathar, the son of Ithamar, of that branch, both are side by side as the priests of David. Until Abiathar is convinced to go against David by Ahithophel, who at that juncture, Solomon gets on the throne, runs Ahithophel off, doesn't kill him, but runs him off because he had been a friend of his father. And from that juncture on, Zadok becomes the chief priest and his line. In fact, that whole Zadokian line of the priesthood, that goes on out into the millennium. Look, if you will, real quick in Ezekiel. This is the last thing we'll cover tonight. Ezekiel chapter 40. When you track it all down, the Zadokian line from through Eleazar is the one that goes on out into the millennium. Look in Ezekiel chapter 40 and verse 46. Context here is the millennial temple. Verse 45, and he said unto me, this chamber whose prospect is toward the south, it is for the priests, the keepers of the charge of the house. The chamber whose prospect is toward the north is for the priests, the keeper of the charge of the altar. These are the sons of Zadok, among the sons of Levi, which came near to the Lord to minister unto him. So all the way out into the millennium, the Zadokian line of the priests is still operating. Look down in chapter 43, verse 19, still talking about the altar and the ordinances of the millennial temple when Christ is ruling and reigning. Verse 19, and thou shalt give to the priests, the Levites, that be of the seed of Zadok, which approach unto me to minister unto me, saith the Lord. So it's the Zadokian priesthood that's running the sacrifices and ordinances of the millennial temple. It's kind of cool. Questions or comments? All righty. Let's sing one before we go tonight. Tell you what,